13 Lectures on the Apocalypse, Lecture 8a. We have a somewhat difficult task tonight in the attempt to present a condensed and intelligible view of the matters involved in chapters 12 and 13. Our task, however, is somewhat simplified by the circumstances that some of the matters have already been under our consideration in connection with other symbols. The consideration of these matters, again, takes us backward in the course of time, a long way back from the point we reached at the end of the 11th chapter. You will recollect that at the end of that chapter, we arrived at the time for the dead to be raised and for the kingdoms of the world to be transferred to Christ as God's vice regent upon earth. In chapter 12, we find ourselves again face to face with the age of Roman imperialism and circumstances of persecution, as for instance in verse 17, the dragon was wroth with the woman and went to make war with the remnant of her seed, which kept the commandments of God and have the testimony of Jesus Christ. It must be evident that this is long before the transfer of the kingdoms of the world to Christ. For when that point is reached, all persecution will have ceased, power being taken from the adversary and vested in Jesus and his brethren. Hence, the conclusion is self-evident that, as in the case of chapter 11, so in the case of this chapter 12, we are taken away back from the point reached at the end of the previous chapter and brought to the consideration of other scenes having to do with the prior history of human government upon earth. It may strike us as strange that there should be this zigzag sort of order in the exhibition of the scenes of the apocalypse. This feeling will disappear if we realize that there are various departments in this divine program that have filled up the interval since Christ's departure from the earth, various areas of the Roman habitable in which the plan has been worked out, various channels in which providential superintendence has been actively giving shape to events with a view to the great consummation appointed. At one time east, at another west, at another both together. And by these various roads, we are several times brought to the same general end to which they all reach. It is as if a guide conducted you by one route to some interesting spot and then took you back through the air, if that were possible, to another outward place from which to conduct you again by a different route to the same spot, and repeated the performance for a third route, and so on. The opening of chapter 12 takes us back to the place in history marked by the sixth seal, when a mighty revolution upset and abolished the pagan government of the world, the avowed enemy of Christ, and established in its place a system based upon professed allegiance to Christ. This revolution, effected under the leadership of Constantine, the first Christian emperor, was a great revolution. Was in fact the inauguration of Christendom, the commencement of the nominal dominion of Christ on the earth, to be succeeded by his real dominion. That nominal dominion was far from being a system of real submission to Christ. Still, it was a great improvement upon the empire of polytheism in a variety of ways. There was hereafter at least a recognition, though in a corrupt form, of the God of Israel and the Lord Jesus Christ, and the adoption of precepts having a humanizing effect on society. In connection with this change, there were details which could not be represented by the sixth seal. The sixth seal merely exhibited the occurrence of the revolution under the symbol of a catastrophe in nature. It could not show how it affected the friends of Christ among themselves. And this is what is done in chapter 12. John sees a certain woman clothed with the sun and the moon under her feet. This woman, like all the women of the apocalypse, was a symbolic woman. And there is no difficulty in seeing whom she symbolizes. The woman represents that section of mankind which had come under submission to God through Christ, as shown by the statement in the verse already read, that the dragon made war upon the woman's seed, who explained to be those who keep the commandments of God and the testimony of Jesus Christ. This use of a woman to represent the community of those who belong to Christ is common to the writings of the apostles, as you know. Paul writes to the Corinthians, "I have espoused you to one husband, that I may present you as a chaste virgin to Christ." Again, Ephesians, "The husband is the head of the wife, even as Christ is the head of the church." The church is apocalyptically described as the bride, the Lamb's wife, in Revelation 21. And his union with her at his coming is spoken of as the marriage supper of the Lamb. In this 12th chapter of the Revelation, however, it is Christ's church or ecclesia in Christ's absence and in the land of his enemies that is the subject of representation. Consequently, there are features about the symbol that will not appertain to the Lamb's bride in the day of her glory. In the day of her humiliation and trial, many who are in her and of her do not belong to her, as the letters of the apostles show, and also the parable of Christ, and as the fact of a judgment for separation at his coming implies. It is while she is in this mixed state that the events of this chapter occur. John sees her clothed with the sun and the moon under her feet, and on her head a crown of 12 stars. The sun is always a symbol of power and prosperity. Those in the Roman Empire were identified with the imperial throne. Hence, for Christ's community among men to be lifted from a position of proscription and persecution into a position of political ascendancy and sunshine by the elevation of Constantine, the church's friend, to the throne of pagan Caesarism, the church's enemy was, for that community, considered as a woman to become a woman clothed with the sun. The moon as a symbol stands in the same relation to the symbolic sun as the literal moon does to the literal sun. It is coordinate with the sun, but not equal to it. It shines with it in the same heaven, but borrows its light from it. What power in the Roman state sustained this relation to the Roman sun of imperial power? The priesthood of the national religion, undoubtedly, the religion of the gods of Rome. The pagan hierarchy stood in the same relation to imperialism as the modern established clergy do to the state. They were a power in the state, secondary to the secular power, and sustained by it. The ecclesiastical order is symbolically the moon in any system. In view of this, we can understand the significance of the Christ woman having the moon under her feet when we realize that the pagan priesthood were, by Constantine, placed under the Christian party, then elevated by him to place and power. The diadem of 12 stars is the symbol of the pagan Caesars. There had been 12 Caesars on the imperial throne, from Augustus, the first Roman emperor, to Domitian, the emperor who reigned when John received the Apocalypse. As a matter presented to John, therefore, the diadem destined to be placed on the church's brow as the result of her conflict with paganism was a 12-starred diadem. There were other Caesars after John passed away, but the number at the date of the vision continued to represent the imperial prize of the conflict that was in progress. We have next to consider the meaning of the woman, so situated, being in the state described in the second verse of the chapter we are considering. She, being with child, cried, travailing in birth and pain to be delivered. Behold, a great red dragon, having 7 heads and 10 horns, and the dragon stood before the woman which was ready to be delivered, for to devour her child as soon as it was born. We learn the meaning of this in the contemplation of the events characterizing the history of the epoch. Constantine did not at once ascend the throne of universal dominion. He was the woman's child, political offspring of the church, for a considerable time before he grasped the reins of universal power. His career began in the West. He was the son of Constantius, one of the 4 pagan emperors who ruled the empire conjointly at the close of the 3rd century. Constantius, whose dominion lay in Gaul, that is France, and Britain, considerably sympathized with the Christians and impeded the execution of the dreadful laws promulgated against them by Galerius, the chief emperor, who vowed he would obliterate the Christian name from the earth. But Constantius's son, Constantine, sympathized with the Christians more than his father did, and this being known at Rome caused him to be regarded with great jealousy and aversion by the other emperors. When his father died at York in Britain, the army proclaimed Constantine his successor in the imperial purple. It was not the place of the army at this time in the history of the empire to appoint a successor. The power lay with Galerius, the chief emperor, who, when he heard of the action of the army, was filled with rage. He, however, accepted the nomination with a determination to set it aside by the sword as soon as it was convenient. He did not acknowledge Constantine in the full rank of emperor, but gave him the 4th rank among Roman princes, making, however, secret arrangements at the same time for the invasion of the dominions of Constantine, the western section of the Roman Empire, with a view to his deposition and destruction. Here we have the situation of the first four verses of the 12th chapter. The emancipated woman was pregnant with a political son, whom another power in the East was waiting to devour. This power is symbolized by a great red dragon with seven heads and ten horns and seven crowns upon his heads. The identification of this power with pagan Rome is not only easy but inevitable. We have an explanation of the heads and horns, which leaves no escape. The heads are declared to represent, in chapter 17, first, the seven hills on which the woman, at a later stage of Roman history, sat enthroned. Rome is built on seven hills, and this literal feature is incorporated in the symbol by way of identification. And secondly, seven sovereignties or forms of supreme power that had succeeded one another on the seven hills, of which the one existing in John's day was, in the verses referred to, declared to be the sixth. The ten horns stood for the division of the empire into ten contemporaneous independent sovereignties at a later time. The symbol was a prophecy as well as an emblem. That is to say, it not only stood for the power of Imperial Rome in the way the lion stands for British power, but it exhibited details that were to be evolved in the course of its history. It is for this reason that we find pagan Rome in hostility to the Christ woman's political son, represented by a ten-horned monster, at a time when the ten horns had not as yet historically made their appearance. If there were no other evidence that the ten-horned dragon of the chapter we're considering stands for pagan Rome at this juncture, it is found in the last six words of verse 3, which might easily escape the reader's notice as having anything in them. Seven crowns upon his heads. In the next chapter, the same symbol has ten crowns on the horns and not on the heads. There's a very obvious reason for this difference. The crown is a symbol of sovereign authority. At the time of Constantine, the ten horns had not historically appeared. Therefore, they are crownless. But the heads had appeared and were in authority, for the emperorship was the sixth head or form of Roman sovereignty. The epoch current in Constantine's days was the epoch of the heads, not of the horns, which had received no kingdom as yet. Therefore, the crowns are on the heads, which is of itself a convincing proof that the seven-headed dragon of Revelation 12 stands for pagan imperial Rome in its attitude of hostility to the Christ woman or church who had in her midst the son to whom she was about to give birth in the full-blown possession of imperial power. The birth of this imperial son was brought about by the very attitude adopted by the pagan dragon. When Constantine, the son with which the woman had just become clothed, ascertained the hostile intentions of the Roman emperor, he resolved upon taking the first step himself in the war which was about to be forced upon him. He threw his army across the Alps before Maxentius, who had taken the place of Galerius, deceased, was aware that he had begun to move. And, encountering the opposing army, three times as numerous as his own, he overthrew it with great slaughter and marched towards Rome. Another army and another were collected to oppose him, but both dispersed before the celerity of his movements and the vigor of his blows. And the Roman Senate, after his third victory at Saxa Rubra, threw open the gates of Rome and proclaimed him Emperor of the Romans. Thus, the woman's son was born after a season of acute parturition agonies. But he was not yet what he was destined to become, sole monarch of the Roman world. This destiny is expressed by the symbolism of verse 5. She brought forth a man-child who was to rule all nations with a rod of iron, and her child was caught up unto God and to his throne. Some apply this to the ascension of Christ. A moment's reflection will suffice to show this is a mistake. What John saw was a representation of things which a voice told him must come to pass hereafter. He was told this AD 96. How then could this scene represent an event that had taken place 60 years before? Besides, such an interpretation would ignore the primary characteristic of the apocalypse as an exhibition of things in sign or hieroglyph. No. The woman in the case is the Christian community, and her son, the imperial champion, begotten in her midst as the result of the operation of her principles on Roman society. This son, in being born and caught up to God and to his throne, was one, to become developed as an acknowledged emperor, and two, to be elevated in the operations of providence into the position of sole monarch of the world. God ruleth in the kingdoms of men. Hence, for Constantine to be placed over them by all the force of circumstances was symbolically to be caught up to God and to his throne. This came about in due time. Meanwhile, we have to consider the events of verse 6. The woman fled into the wilderness, where she hath a place prepared of God, that they should feed her there 1,260 days. This seems a strange sequel to the events of the early part of the chapter. It is, however, in harmony with the course of affairs as they developed themselves after Constantine's elevation in Rome. While the woman, or Christian community, of which Constantine declared himself protector, continued in the sun-invested position in the heaven to which events had elevated her, the woman, in another sense, fled the position and became the object of persecution of the new and nominally Christian government. To see this clearly, it is necessary to realize that the community developed by the labors of the apostles contained two elements: the real and the unreal, the actual and the nominal. Those who were earnestly subject to the law of Christ, and those who were professors without heart, who accepted Christ as a tradition but were uninfluenced by it in a practical way. The latter were in the majority. It was by their means that the political revolution in favor of Christianity was brought about. They were not fastidious about the commandments of Christ, which forbid the use of the sword or identification with the politics of the present evil world. Therefore, they felt themselves at liberty to plot and intrigue and fill the army and officers of state and set up a military champion in Constantine. The other class, described as those who keep the commandments of God and have the testimony of Jesus Christ, were the minority, an element, a remnant in the midst of others. And broadly viewed, they were both one community and therefore, in relation to the pagan dragon, one woman. In another relation of things, they were two. The one the shell, the other the kernel. The one the shadow, the other the substance. To the one class, Jesus tells us, he will say in the day of account, I never knew you. To the other, he will unite himself in glorious marriage as a bridegroom to a bride. In the ultimate aspect of things, the latter class only are the woman, the bride, the Lamb's wife. And although in relation to the aspects of human history, the nominal are part of the woman as well as the true, yet in even the current recognitions of Christ, the true only are the woman. The false are finally symbolized in the apocalypse as a shameless prostitute. It is in view of these distinctions that we are unable to understand how it came to pass that after the woman had been invested with the son of imperial favor, the woman should fly into the wilderness. As a matter of fact, ecclesiastically considered, the woman remained in the region of sunshine. The Christian party continued in the position to which Constantine's success elevated her. But shortly after its elevation, there was a schism which resulted in the separation of the community into two parts, one of which fled from the presence of imperial favor and became the object of the persecution of the other. One party was zealous for the commandments of God, and the other were worldly time servers. The schism, though long existing as a spiritual fact, only became openly visible on the appointment to a bishopric of a man who, during the dreadful persecution of Diocletian and Galerius, had given up the scriptures to save his life. The faithful could not brook such a violation of Christian decorum and refused to recognize the man that had been appointed, and the dispute raged with great bitterness. And it came several times before Constantine, who decided in favor of the reprobate, who was the favorite of the court party. The decision resulted in the flight of the woman, both in the spiritual and the geographical sense. She fled from the presence of the court, saying through one of their leading writers, "What has the emperor to do with the church? What have Christians to do with kings? And what have bishops to do at court?" And she flew from the Roman soil and took refuge in the African provinces of the Roman Empire, territory forming the southern margin of the Mediterranean, the northern fringe of the African continent. Here she was fed and nourished, and afterwards spreading herself into the southern parts of Europe, she sustained in the capacity of the two witnesses that 1260 days or years of testimony in the presence of her persecutors, which we had to consider in the last lecture. Here a question will occur to many. Are we to consider, then, that the churches in Rome and Africa in the 4th and 5th centuries and the various dissenting bodies in Switzerland, France, and other parts were the true brethren of Christ? If so, why is it that we, the Christadelphians, consider the truth is not to be found in their writings? Some make use of this argument to reject the truth. This is a great mistake. The question of the truth is not to be settled by reference to human documents or human constructions of history. We must inquire concerning this at the holy oracles alone. to the law and to the testimony. If any speak not according to this word, it is because there is no light in them. Yes, yes, says the objector, very good, but how are we to deal with a question asked? The answer is that though these communions were not in the Mass, the body of Christ, they contained it. While the Church ascendant, the Catholic sun-invested woman, contained it, and not at all. There is evidence that the heretics as a class contained the Brethren of Christ in their symbolization as the witnesses, but the same symbolization representing them as two brings with it the evidence that, like Israel after the flesh, they were not all Israel that were of Israel. Fragmentary writings exhibiting affinities with the truth present the same evidence. But even if there were no such evidence, we should be unwise in allowing the uncertainties of history to weaken our perceptions of truth. In all our conceptions of truth and duty, we must be governed wholly by the Scripture. We know we are safe here, whereas in dealing with matters of which there is no authentic record, we are on slippery ground. Going back to the days of her flight, before Constantine had yet become supreme ruler of the Roman world, we read, "And there was war in heaven. Michael and his angels fought against the dragon, and the dragon fought and his angels and prevailed not. Neither was their place found any more in heaven. And the great dragon was cast out, that old serpent called the devil and Satan, which deceiveth the whole world. He was cast out into the earth, and his angels were cast out with him. And I heard a voice saying in heaven, now is come salvation and strength, and the kingdom of our God, and the power of his Christ. For the accuser of our brethren is cast down, which accused them before our God day and night. And they overcame him by the blood of the Lamb, and by the word of their testimony. And they loved not their lives unto the death." In these verses, we have a symbolical representation of the struggle that elevated Constantine from the position of ruler of a third of the Roman Empire, in conjunction with his pagan colleagues who ruled the remaining thirds, to the position of sole emperorship. It was a struggle in which the testimony for Christ, sown in previous centuries of tears and blood, obtained final victory over paganism and banished it from the system of the civilized world. It was a struggle conducted in heaven. That is, it was war among the rulers. Maximin, the emperor of the Eastern or Asiatic third of the empire, made war on Licinius, the ruler of the Middle or Illyrian third, with a fatal result to Maximin, whose dominions, on his overthrow by Licinius, were added to those of the latter. Licinius, emboldened by his success, and hating the pro-Christian policy of Constantine, the ruler of the Western or Roman third, resolved to put forth his power against Constantine and to re-establish paganism throughout the empire. And this brought on war between Licinius and Constantine, which, after several great battles, each a victory for Constantine, ended in the complete overthrow of Licinius and the expulsion of paganism from the government of the Roman world. Constantine became sole emperor, and Christianity the only recognized religion of the state from Persia to the Atlantic. This was the triumph of the symbolic Michael and his angels over the dragon and his angels. Michael, meaning who like God, was the symbolic name of Constantine as the instrument by which God cast the idols from the throne of the world and substituted thereon, in a preliminary way, the name of his son. As opposed to this enterprise, pagan imperialism was the political incorporation of the original diabolism of human nature, and therefore that old serpent, the devil and Satan, which deceiveth the whole world. the wrath of this devil on his ejection from heaven, that is Italy, the heaven proper of the Roman system, and the woe announced for the inhabitants of the earth and sea on his descent among them, refer to the stages in the process by which during 12 years pagan superstition was driven by degrees from all places and power in the Roman habitable. In the latter stages, when Licinius, after his overthrow of Maximin, conceived hostile intentions against Constantine, the devil was filled with great wrath, knowing his time was short, and he persecuted the woman that had brought forth the man-child. That is, he promulgated oppressive laws against the Christian community in his dominions. The literature of the times bears evidence that there was a general presentiment of that paganism was doomed, which stirred up its supporters under the leadership of Licinius to supreme efforts, which brought war and devastation on the inhabitants of the eastern and maritime districts of the empire. In 12 years from the commencement of the conflict, the political Michael was entirely victorious, and the old serpent, the devil, and Satan, as incorporated in the venerable paganism of Greece and Rome, was utterly cast down. When these events were consummated, there were great rejoicings among the Christian party surrounding Constantine, throughout the whole empire, who from that time imagined that the kingdom of Christ had really come by the hand of Constantine. This was the loud voice of verse 10, a voice in heaven in the ruling sphere saying, now is come salvation and strength in the kingdom of our God. It was only, however, in a preliminary, typical and shadowy sense that this had come to pass. It is only when the seventh trumpet sounds that the kingdoms of the world become the kingdoms of Christ, as we have seen. The loud voice represents the exaltations that actually took place, as ecclesiastical history testifies, but does not necessarily guarantee these exaltations as representing the accurate truth in all particulars. In verse 14, we have the flight of the faithful woman again introduced. We've considered the meaning of this in connection with verse 6. Verse 14 adds the information by telling us where the woman was to be nourished. Two wings of a great eagle, or as it is in the original, the great eagle, were given to her, that she might fly into the wilderness state. Understanding the Roman power to be meant by the great eagle, and this was one of Rome's leading symbols, the wings would indicate the outlying provinces of the Roman jurisdiction. The city of Rome itself was the head of the eagle, Italy its body, and the countries east and west, subject to its authority, its wings. History shows us that it was in these wings where the witnessing community were nourished. In verses 15 and 16, we have the serpent, also styled the dragon, exhibited as the persecutor of the woman for a lengthened period. After the overthrow of the pagan dragon, the actual persecutor in the case was the government of Constantine under the instigation of the bishops of the Catholic Church of the court party. And this creates a seeming difficulty in view of the fact that the pagan dragon was finally disposed of by the victories of Constantine. It is a staggering at first sight to find the dragon stand for paganism and then for the Christian government of Constantine, who overthrew paganism. The explanation is to be found in the fact that though in the conflict in which Constantine, as the Christian ruler of a part of the empire, contended against paganism as the champion of the Christian name, only paganism could be considered as the serpent and adversary. Yet afterwards, when Constantine occupied the dragon capital, Byzantium, afterwards called Constantinople, and had absorbed the dragon territory into his dominions and became, in his turn, an adversary and persecutor of the remnant of the woman's seed, his government became transformed into the political serpent and dragon as distinctly as his pagan predecessors. Therefore, the vision, which has more to do with the nature of things than their nominal distinctions, retains the serpent dragon as the symbol of the church's persecutors, when those persecutors were nominally the church's protectors. The vision is thus in harmony with events as they unfolded themselves in fact. Though out of it with historical nomenclature from a human point of view, in this it gives one of many marks of its divinity. It is after the analogy of the symbol of the woman, which in one relation of things is the community of the faithful, and in another, the apostate church, an adulterous association with the kings of the earth. In the water mentioned in verse 15, which the dragon cast out of his mouth to overwhelm the woman, we may recognize the military expeditions dispatched by the Catholic government against the schismatics in the Roman wings. And the earth helping the woman, opening her mouth to absorb the flood and to save the woman, we see prefigured the aid that was rendered to the faithful Christian community by the lawless lovers of liberty in Africa, emphatically the earth, who resorted to violent measures in their defense. The particulars, which are very interesting, will be found very fully set forth in the third volume of Eureka, and we cannot do more on the present occasion than indicate the interpretation. The dragon was wroth with a woman and went to make war with the remnant of her seed. In the carrying out of this war during the ages that followed, the ecclesiastical enmity of the remnant of the woman's seed underwent various political transformations, which are the subject of chapter 13. John, standing upon the sand of the sea, sees a beast rise up out of the sea, having 7 heads and 10 horns, and upon his horns 10 crowns. The 7 heads and 10 horns show the Roman nature of the power represented, and the crowns being on the horns and not on the heads shows the time or era. It is the new organization of the Roman world in the West, long after the era of Constantine, when the days of a single imperial rule had passed away and the 10 kings had made their appearance and acquired their sovereignty in Europe. Upon his heads the name of blasphemy. The papacy is the name of blasphemy, and the heads the 7 hills upon which it is established. The beast, therefore, has to do with papal times. These had not arrived in the days of Constantine. The popeship was in the germ, even then in the office and pretensions of the Bishop of Rome. Still, it was not a developed institution. It did not become the name of blasphemy enthroned on the 7 hills of Rome till nearly 300 years afterward. The dragon gave him his power and his seat and great authority. The dragon, as we have seen, first represented the political paganism of Rome in its opposition to the Christian name in the West. This political paganism was headed up in Licinius, whose seat of government was Byzantium, afterwards called Constantinople. Licinius in the East, Byzantium, Constantine in the West, Rome, presented at this time the historical counterpart of the dragon and his angels on the one side and Michael and his angels on the other. When Constantine had overthrown Licinius, he transferred his capital from Rome to Byzantium, which he built anew and named Constantinople. Here he and his successors became what Licinius's government had been before them, the dragon. They did so by reason of occupying the same capital, ruling the same territory, and assuming the same hostility towards the true witnesses of Christ. It was from Constantinople that the persecution of the church emanated in Constantinian and succeeding times. Constantinople continued to be the throne of the dragon, though professedly Christian in character. Recognition of this is necessary to enable us to understand the statement that the dragon gave to the beast of the sea, his power and his seat and great authority. It was from the emperor reigning in Constantinople in the east that the papacy in the west received its constitution and recognition, or its power and seat and great authority. History of the uprising of the papacy will show you this. The dragon had the power to bestow and bestowed it on the bishop of Rome. After wavering for some time between the Bishop of Rome and the Bishop of Constantinople, the competition between Rome and Constantinople for the headship of Christendom extended over more than a century. It was terminated in favor of Rome by the Emperor Justinian in AD 535, and finally confirmed and established by his successor, the Emperor Phocas, in AD 606. I saw one of his heads as it were wounded unto death, and his deadly wound was healed. And all the world wondered after the beast. The sixth head of the Roman beast, that is the sixth of its seven historic forms of government, the imperial, received an apparently fatal wound from the sword of the Goths. The Roman Empire was totally extinguished in the West, the kingdom of the Goths taking its place for a short time, that is for 70 years. At the end of that time, the forces of the dragon, the armies of the emperor at Constantinople, restored the imperial authority in Italy by defeating and expelling the Gothic forces and putting an end to the Gothic interregnum. Afterwards, on the ground thus cleared, Roman imperialism was restored in the crowning of Charlemagne in Rome as Roman Emperor of the West. Thus, the sixth head of the Roman beast was healed, to the admiration and astonishment of the world, who rejoiced in the evidently perennial vigor of the ancient imperialism of Rome, reinvigorated from Constantinople. And this state of mind is indicated in the statement that all the world wondered after the beast, and they worshipped the dragon which gave power unto the beast. And there was given unto him the beast a mouth speaking great things and blasphemies, and power was given to him to continue AV margin to make war 42 months. To the Roman beast in its papal constitution was given by the dragonic imperial decree from Constantinople authority to dictate to the world in spiritual things. The Roman pontiff in his official utterances was this mouth, whose great speakings were blasphemies. Power also to wield the sword in enforcement of the ecclesiastical ascendancy was accorded by the same settlement of things by the Constantinople or Dragonic Ordinance. The duration of that power was not defined in the Dragonic Decree, but it was fixed in the Councils of Providence. The papacy was to possess the power for 42 months. We are living at the end of the period, and we can see that the word of God has been fulfilled exactly 1260 years from its first institution by the Emperor Justinian in AD 535, namely at the close of the last century during the French Revolution. It received a terrible blow at the hands of the first Napoleon. But the first institution of papal power was only preliminary, and therefore 1260 from that time could not be the full termination, but from its confirmation established by Phocas in 606, there's another starting point, and that brings us to AD 1867, when the French, on their return, rescued the Pope from Garibaldi, took possession of the so-called Holy City, and virtually terminated the Pope's power to make war against his enemies. 3 years later, even the shadow of the temporal power disappeared in the conflict between France and Germany. And in 1880, the Pope is known among his friends as the prisoner of the Vatican. His power is gone. The government of the King of Italy is possession of the city. the Pope is reduced to the position of a mere bishop again, and he's obliged to tolerate dissenting chapels before his very eyes, and is powerless to stop the free circulation of the Bible, which has never been allowed in Rome during the 42 months. And this is a great sign that we're near the end of the present order. Verse 11, John beholds another beast come up out of the sea, not out of the sea, but out of the earth. It is another form of the papal beast, as proved by the statement in verse 12, that he causeth them that dwell therein to worship the first beast whose deadly wound was healed. You may ask, why should there be another form of the papal beast? Because in the progress of events, the papal ascendancy took an entirely new phase. The Constantinopolitan dragon of the East, who in the first place gave him his authority, finally became of no account. And from the interior regions of Europe, and therefore from the earth, apocalyptically speaking, as contrasted with the Mediterranean seaboard, there now sprang up a new conquering power which obtained the controlling ascendancy in Europe and incorporated the papacy in itself in a new order of things. This was the Germanic Empire, springing out of the order of things established by the victories of Charlemagne, King of the French, the Emperor of the Romans. Let anyone read the history of this Germanic Empire, which slowly and peaceably shifted from France to Germany and finally to Austria as the leading German power, and they will find that it had two horns, or was constituted of two contemporary dynasties, namely the Emperor and the Pope. These were the two leading features of the empire to which the rest of Europe was subject. The Pope held his position subject to the confirmation of the Emperor, and the Emperor did not hold a valid position till he received his crown at the hands of the Pope. It was a dual empire, a two-horned beast. They were lamb-like horns, that is, by profession they belonged to Christ. Between them they were Christendom. But the beast spake like a dragon, for all that. Nature and principles, it was thoroughly dragonic, though ostensibly holding a lamb-like character. Let anyone study the deeds of the Pope and Emperor, and they will see the truthfulness of this symbolism. No more merciless tyranny ever afflicted earth than that which, under the name of the Holy Roman Empire, caused the tears and blood of thousands to flow in dire persecution and oppression under pretense of authority from Christ. The two-horned beast caused the earth and them that dwell therein to worship the first beast whose deadly wound was healed. The first beast, being Rome in the first stage of her papal constitution, was now incorporated in the two-horned beast. It was merged or fused with it. This is proved by the fact that the latter exercised all the power of the first beast, and proved also by the history and facts of the case. The first beast was revived in the constitution of the second, insofar as imperial rank was restored to Rome and the Roman Empire reinstated in the West. In the new empire created by the proclamation of Charlemagne as Roman Emperor by the Pope. And this was the healing of the wounded sixth head, and by the public proclamation of the new empire, the earth and the dwellers therein were commanded to worship the first beast whose deadly wound was healed. The great wonders which the new beast was able to perform consisted of the prodigies of war for which Charlemagne is famous in history. Victorious Charlemagne, accepted and crowned by the Pope, had the power to give political vitality to the papal image of the beast, and this power he exercised and ordered the worship of the Pope King on pain of death, causing all to receive a mark in their right hand or in their forehead that no man might buy or sell save he had the mark or the name of the beast or the number of his name. This was the symbolic way of setting forth that under the new system, the authority of the papal image would be made essential to the holding of any office or the exercise of any traffic in the emoluments or advantages of church or state. And as this authority was conferred by signing the cross on the forehead or right hand of the recipient of official favour, the cross became the subject of this symbolism as the mark of the beast. The name of the beast or the number of his name were equivalent symbols of the same thing. Those who know the name of the beast or the number of his name are in the secret as to what is meant by the symbol. It is the number of a man, so says the last verse. That is, when you have found the system represented by the name of the beast, you will find the system is centered in a man, though the man and the system are two things. The perception of this enigma is made a feat of wisdom in verse 18. The answer is before us in the Greek name Latinos, which in plain English may be said to mean Latindom or Latin power, kingdom or church headed up in the Pope. And the letters of this name added together according to their arithmetical value give the result 666.